So the morning, the first article in the news was about the Department of Defense, and I'm sure other people have seen this as well, the Department of Defense in the US apologizing for a drone strike against suspected Islamic State militants in Kabul a few weeks ago whilst they were withdrawing from 20 years of war in Afghanistan. They admitted that their multi-gazillion dollar intelligence and military apparatus had mistaken a Toyota Corolla that belonged to a family for one they thought was owned by Islamic State militants that they thought were going to attack Kabul airport. They admitted that they killed 7 children and 3 adults, innocent civilians, in the attack. US Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin apologized to the relatives of those killed in the statement that he made. He said, "We apologize and we will endeavor to learn from this horrible mistake." The article that I read next, which was the headline article linked to this apology statement from the US, was titled "Dutton Warns of War with China." So that's how much they've learnt from the 20 years of carnage that they've inflicted on the people of Afghanistan. So where I want to start is by reading a statement, part of a statement that was given by the Revolutionary Association of the Women of Afghanistan. They issued this statement on the 1st of September, and I think it's the best response to the events we've heard about this morning and the whole of the past 20 years. They said, "In the past 20 years, one of our demands was an end to the US-NATO occupation, and even better, if they take their Islamic fundamentalists and technocrats with them and let our people decide our own fate. This occupation only resulted in bloodshed, destruction, and chaos. They turned our country into the most corrupt, insecure, drug mafia, and dangerous place, especially for women. The Pentagon proves that none of the theory of invasion or meddling ended up in safe conditions. All imperialist powers invade countries for their own strategic, political, and financial interests, but through lies and the powerful corporate media try to hide their real motive and agenda." So let's start with some of the lies. In September of 2011, when the Bush administration signaled its intention to launch its war on terror and invade Afghanistan, George Bush said, "Every nation in every region now has a decision to make. Either you're with us or you're with the terrorists." In the same speech in which he made these remarks, he issued a demand that the Taliban deliver Osama bin Laden and the leaders of the bin Laden organization, who they accused of the 9/11 terrorist attacks, to the United States and end all support for terrorism. He said, and I'm quoting him, "The Taliban must act and act immediately. They will hand over the terrorists or they will share in their fate." And so what happened? How did the Taliban respond? They responded by offering to hand bin Laden over. On the 5th of October 2001, 2 days before the US bombing of Afghanistan began, the Taliban ambassador to Pakistan, Abdul Salam Zaif, and Taliban Foreign Minister Wakil Ahmed Motawakil offered that if the US provided evidence of bin Laden's guilt in the 9/11 attacks, they would hand him over. And then again on the 15th of October, as US bombs were raining down on Afghanistan, the Taliban offered to hand bin Laden over to the custody of the Organization of the Islamic Conference, which is an organization based in Saudi Arabia, to be tried for the 9/11 attacks. Afghanistan's Deputy Prime Minister, Haji Abdul Kabir, told the world's media, "If the Taliban is given evidence that Osama bin Laden is involved and the bombing campaign stopped, quote, we would be ready to hand him over to a third country." Bush and his neocon warhawks said no. They did not even countenance stopping the bombing and entering into any kind of discussions about bin Laden's handover. And so none of those quotes from the Taliban are to pour glory or legitimize the Taliban. The Taliban should be wiped off the face of the earth. But they are statements that indicate the abject lies and cynicism of the whole rhetoric of the war on terror. Approximately 3 months later, the Taliban in Afghanistan had been completely wiped out by the United States. The US and its NATO partners, with Australia being the most enthusiastic partner outside of Britain, had airily bombarded Taliban targets in the country so ferociously and decisively that the Taliban were decimated. Their leadership were either killed or they fled to Pakistan. And those that were left in Afghanistan subsequently went to extraordinary lengths, actually, to either declare their support for the newly installed US puppet government of Hamid Karzai or to demonstrate that they'd given up their arms, they disbanded their militias, which is what they did do, and many of them simply retired. They either went back to traditional villages to farm, they went back to previous jobs like teaching and driving buses. They were defeated. They gave up. But the US's imperialist strategy when it invaded Afghanistan was not just about getting revenge for the 9/11 attacks. That was part of it, though. It was much, much bigger than that. And that's why they didn't leave after they destroyed the Taliban. That's why they wouldn't negotiate on the capture and surrender of Osama bin Laden to a third country, because their openly stated imperialist strategy at the dawn of the 21st century was to shore up their power by dominating the world militarily, and domination of the Middle East region and influence over the regimes in this region was a key focus of this strategy. And that's what I'm going to argue in this talk. That's what I'm going to argue has been, at the core of what the war in Afghanistan has been all about. Contrary to the justifications prosecuted by the ruling class and the hegemonic backing they've received by liberals the world over in their liberal defence of murder, that the invasion and occupation of Afghanistan were humanitarian interventions to bring freedom and democracy and feminism, women's rights to Afghanistan, or to destroy a global terrorist threat. The war in Afghanistan was about the imperatives of US capitalism and US imperialism to protect and increase the wealth of the US capitalist class and their power by militarily dominating the most geostrategically important areas of the world. And then by extension, about those same priorities for the other imperialist countries that joined the US in its so-called war on terror. When the US launched its first airstrikes in Afghanistan on the 7th of October 2001, Afghanistan was the fourth poorest country in the world. It had then and still has now the highest infant mortality rates in the world. Average life expectancy was 56 years. Rampant life-threatening poverty was the norm for most people, 90% of whom lived in the vast rural expanses of the country without anything like access to adequate nutrition or clean water. By 2001, when the US, with the backing of its imperialist partners, invaded, Afghanistan had already been categorically wrecked, destroyed by decades of war. One of the expressions that was commonly used to describe Afghanistan before the US invaded was the term reduced to rubble. It had been reduced to rubble by a Soviet occupation between 1979 to 1989 that was based on the priorities of Soviet imperialism, which was to occupy a country within what it considered to be its geostrategic territory, to exert control over the flow of energy resources like oil and gas, to keep its rivals out of a geographical area, which is a gateway country on the north-south axis of Central Asia, wedged between corridors to Asia and the Middle East. So both key regions of the world to influence and control from the perspective of global and regional imperialist powers. The Soviet war resulted in this sort of two-pronged war within Afghanistan. So one arm of the war was the war waged by the Soviet Union against the people of Afghanistan. That resulted in 1 million Afghans killed and millions more turned into refugees. And the second prong of that war became a war fought between the US and the Soviet Union within Afghanistan. With the US determined to expel the Soviet Union, its imperialist rival, from this important region in the final stages of the Cold War between those two imperialist powers. The fallout from that conflict between the Soviet Union and the US within Afghanistan, which ended in 1989 with the US winning, was a decade of brutal civil war between rival Islamist militants and local warlords who had been funded in the previous decade to the tune of eventually billions of dollars by the United States to fight the Soviet Union out of Afghanistan. The US, and not just the US, but also Saudi Arabia, Pakistan, to some extent the United Kingdom and China, funded what is now known as the Mujahideen, which is the umbrella term for groups of fighters and Islamic militants that were trained in Pakistan. They were funded by the US and those other imperialist powers. They were assisted and facilitated by US allies like Egypt and Israel, and they were quite directly orchestrated by the Pakistani ISI, the intelligence services. The Pakistani ISI funneled weapons and money to Mujahideen fighters, who they and the CIA working together recruited not just from Afghanistan, but around the region and around the world. They were trained in Pakistan. They were very willing to take the guns and money to destroy and expel a common enemy in Afghanistan, the Soviet Union. But when the US won and withdrew from Afghanistan, these different factions of Mujahideen fighters, many of whom were linked to rival landowners across the vast and mostly rural areas of Afghanistan, where most of the population live, they turned their guns on each other and then the population in an attempt to wrest control of the country. What I think is important to understand about this civil war that eventually led to the victory of the Taliban by 1986 was that the kind of brutal, reactionary, anti-woman form of Islamist ideology and practice that the Taliban cultivated to enforce its rule was very consciously, explicitly promoted by the CIA during the Soviet war. First under a Democratic president, Jimmy Carter, and then the Republican president, Ronald Reagan, who called the Mujahideen at the time freedom fighters. When the Mujahideen were fighting on their side, they were freedom fighters. The US fomented, financed, and actively encouraged the most utterly macabre reactionary strains of militant Islamism, not variants of Islamism that had previously existed in Afghanistan. And this was connected to the US's own stated goals of wanting to inflict a version of their own humiliating defeat in Vietnam on their rival, the Soviet Union. And they knew it was going to destroy Afghanistan. In August 1979, a classified State Department report bluntly asserted, and I'm quoting from it, that the United States' larger interest would be served by the demise of the Tariq-i-Amin regime, which was the Soviet regime, despite whatever setbacks this might mean for future social and economic reforms in Afghanistan. So the US deliberately chose to give the most support to the most extreme groups to hurt the Russians. A disproportionate share of US arms went to an Afghan warlord named Gulbuddin Hekmatyar, who is back, by the way, associated with the new Taliban ministry, who, according to a US journalist, a guy called Tim Weiner, was, and I'm quoting him, a particularly fanatical fundamentalist and woman hater. According to Weiner, quote, Hekmatyar's followers first gained attention by throwing acid in the faces of women who refused to wear the veil. CIA and State Department officials I've spoken with call him scary, vicious, a fascist, definite dictatorship material. And then, of course, we know through all sorts of credible reports of the links between the CIA and Osama bin Laden, who, as a wealthy businessman from Saudi Arabia, a long-term US ally with links to the royal family there, worked closely with the CIA to recruit thousands of Islamist fighters from Saudi Arabia with the assistance of large funds from private Saudi citizens. What there is absolutely no doubt about is that the formation of al-Qaeda took place during the Civil War, when bin Laden, with US and Saudi funds and weapons, was leading a faction, or he had been leading a faction during the Afghan War as one of Ronald Reagan's so-called freedom fighters in the Mujahideen, the very freedom fighters that the US went on to declare as a global terrorist threat in its war on terror. So once you get to 2001 and the terrorist attacks in New York and Washington, I think that it's obvious that revenge was one of the motives for the US invading Afghanistan. But the revenge component coalesced with what was described by Condoleezza Rice, George Bush's Secretary of State, in 2001 in a security state meeting as, quote, an opportunity to implement what the foreign policy aspirations of the US were at the dawn of the 21st century. And in their own words, these aspirations were, quote, to preserve and extend the US's position of global leadership by maintaining the preeminence of US military forces. That quote and many more horrifying quotes, like that they would like to see another Pearl Harbor to give them an excuse for enforcing their aspiration of global military dominance. These quotes and many more were outlined outlining the US's very deliberate conscious strategy of shoring up its power and its unrivaled number one position in the global imperialist hierarchy at the dawn of the 21st century are detailed in defense and foreign policy reports that were written prior to the 2001 terrorist attacks by the neoconservative think tank called the Project for a New American Century. And subsequent to those attacks, the attacks of 9/11, by the actions of 10 of the 25 former members of that think tank who became major war criminals, the likes of Donald Rumsfeld and Dick Cheney, Paul Wolfowitz in George Bush's administration. And what makes their overall imperialist strategy clear, obviously, apart from very importantly, what we soon found out were their intentions to invade Iraq, a jewel in the crown of oil-rich geostrategically important countries in the Middle East, is what they did in the past 20 years in Afghanistan and the massive global ideological, legal, military and security apparatuses that have been constructed in Western states all around the world in the past 20 years to underpin the narrative of a global terrorist threat. In a nutshell, as I mentioned at the beginning, after destroying the Taliban within 3 months of invading the US, the US and its NATO partners brought them back to life as a result of the stupendous war crimes they committed, the exact nature of which are obvious in what we've learned about the likes of the SAS's crimes in Afghanistan through the Brereton Report. Their purpose in Afghanistan was to set up a pro-US regime, partly to act as a kind of counterinsurgency state, so as to control Islamic militant groups that represented threats to their geo-imperial interests in the region, and that kind of or threats to regimes that they're allied with in the region. And that kind of operation in the context of how neoliberal wars are conducted now, using massive aerial bombing campaigns, coupled with having lesser numbers of troops on the ground and outsourcing the fighting to local actors on the ground, was a recipe for the clusterfuck of carnage and war crimes that unraveled in the past 20 years. When the US went into Afghanistan, they aerially bombarded the country to wipe out the Taliban, and they faced very little, if really no resistance from the broader population, who hated the Taliban and who were exhausted from decades of war and actually tentatively welcomed the prospect of peace, the promise of humanitarian intervention, building schools, social infrastructure, and so on. But once the US defeated the Taliban, they faced a problem. They'd set a mandate to fight a war on terror. They had, particularly at the beginning of the invasion, thousands of special forces on the ground looking for terrorists, but there's no terrorists. So they begin to incentivize Afghans on the ground with a lot of money and weapons and access to positions as police chiefs and mayors. The US has lauded Afghan security forces to produce terrorists. And it lays the basis for stirring up all sorts of old grievances between tribal groups. Some neighbour got your plot of land in the civil war and so on. Old factional rivalries and so on between old warlords, to the point that not just old retired Taliban leaders, but all sorts of innocent people are falsely identified as Taliban, sent to Guantanamo Bay, sent to the notorious torture camps of Abu Ghraib, Bagram Air Base and so on, have their homes raided, bombed, are maimed and killed in front of their families, wedding parties are semi-regularly bombed. The atrocities committed against innocent people are endless. And all the while, the US has created newly a whole new network of warlords who control the Afghan security forces right across, especially the vast rural expanses of the country where 75% of the population live. And those warlords become new millionaires, drug runners in the massive opium trade that escalates. They terrorize the population of the countryside through extortion and violence funded by the United States. So hardly any of the trillions of dollars that are poured into the so-called war against terrorists for so-called humanitarian interventions ends up building schools and health services across most of the country, where desperately poor women and men and kids live outside the major cities of Kandahar and Kabul, where the mostly educated middle class does benefit from living in highly securitized cities where extremely well-paid Western diplomats and NGO workers and corrupt Afghan politicians live. And it's in this context that the Taliban re-emerges, regrouping in Pakistan and having very little trouble taking back vast swathes of the countryside in recent years. And it's not hard to figure out how they managed to do it and how the so-called Afghan security forces collapse so quickly, when firstly, they've never been a force loyal to the US. 45,000 of them were murdered by the Taliban and in conflict. They're riven with corruption, the Afghan security forces. They're filled with young Afghan men who've always known that they'd be facing, or what they'd be facing once the US left, that they'd be left without the aerial coverage that US planes and drones dropping bombs provides them, and also knowing that the vast majority of Afghans who live in the rural areas of Afghanistan outside the cities hate the corrupt US-backed government of which the security forces are part, that has been complicit in creating the violence and poverty that is the reality of their lives day in and day out. So you can see how the Taliban doesn't face much resistance in this context. So I want to move on to why Australia got involved. The short answer to that is also imperialism, because it was in the interests of the Australian of Australian capitalism to have the Australian state demonstrate its commitment to an imperialist partnership with the US as the world's most powerful economic and military power. The interests of a regional imperialist power like Australia lie in aligning themselves with the US in order to secure backing and access to the strategic advantages of US domination, access to resources, shipping lanes, important global trading routes, military capabilities, intelligence, and so on, so that Australia can throw its weight around in this region of the world. And I think that's pretty clear now when you think about the escalating imperialist tensions and the new deals that are being done between the US and Britain and Australia vis-a-vis nuclear submarines and so on, the situation that's intensifying in this region. And once again, our military and political rulers make all this pretty clear. An adjunct professor at the Australian Defence Force Academy, when asked in 2019 about the real reasons for the war in Afghanistan, he wrote this in the Sydney Morning Herald. "The real reason for the war is, of course, to show we are a willing ANZUS and Western Alliance partner in order to be well regarded by the US and receive the defence and intelligence benefits that go with active membership of the Five Eyes relationship. Afghanistan per se is of little strategic importance to Australia." The then Prime Minister John Howard, who was in Washington on September 11, almost immediately invoked the 50-year-old ANZUS Treaty, committing Australia, New Zealand and the US to support one another if any were attacked, and he was matched unequivocally by Kim Beazley, the leader of the ALP at the time, in pledging support to any US war. In the days after 9/11, no major media outlet would hear a word against the US. The French liberal newspaper Le Monde ran with the now famous headline, "We are all Americans now." Those who said that it was not terrorism but US imperialism that posed the greatest threat to the world were vilified, marginalized, and condemned as terrorist sympathisers. And I was reminded in the last few days of the extent of how absolutely intense that vilification was, with a couple of things. For example, Rage Against the Machine songs were banned in the US and a whole bunch of radio stations. Oprah Winfrey, no radical, proposed running a show called "Is War the Answer" on her television network and was flooded with death threats and hate mail. Things along the lines of saying, "Go back to Africa, bitch." People might remember the Dixie Chicks were vilified and shut down and had their songs banned. In America, there was a campaign to have the word "French" removed from French fries in McDonald's outlets because initially the French came out against an invasion, I think that was a bit later on, against the invasion of Iraq. So this is the kind of level of hysteria that even sort of sentiments of liberal pacifism were met with death threats. So liberals in particular took up the arguments of famous feminist war hawks like Hillary Clinton and the First Lady of the US, Laura Bush, that the so-called good war in Afghanistan, as it was framed by liberals, was a war to liberate Afghan women from the Taliban. On the 16th of November 2001, Laura Bush, in a radio address to the nation, condemned, quote, "the severe repression against women in Afghanistan," and declared, quote, "the fight against terrorism is also a fight for the rights and dignity of women." Which was pretty interesting timing, because in the same week that she said that, the US cut its humanitarian aid to an infant mortality reduction program that it had been contributing to in Afghanistan for quite some time. The contributions of liberals and liberal feminists to this narrative of the good war to save Afghan women from the very warlords that the US had styled as freedom fighters helped to lay the basis for the liberal justifications for the war on terror generally. These justifications spewed out of the ABC from liberal papers like The Guardian, from newly created terrorism studies centres on university campuses, where liberal Islamophobes strengthened the right-wing Islamophobia that vilified and scapegoated Muslims and Arabs as a kind of fifth column threat to the whole world. And the Australian state seized on all of the Islamophobia, the overt right-wing variants that they constructed, as well as the liberal good Muslim, bad Muslim variants, to bolster the idea that we were under threat in this region from a global network of terrorists rather than the real terrorists, which is what those of us on the radical left argued were the US and its accomplices like Australia. We were fed a steady diet from breakfast radio to the nightly news about the axis of evil threatening the world, which was a euphemism to characterise any nation and anyone actually that was against the war on terror. In Australia, we were induced to believe that we were threatened by what Australia called the arc of instability. The arc of instability was a term coined by Australian politicians and journalists in the 1990s that was adopted as a truth by the United Nations Security Council, which proposed that there was an interconnected chain of politically unstable nations in the Asia Pacific, i.e. those nations that wanted Australia to stop meddling in their countries and stealing their resources like Australia did in East Timor. But we were told that Australia should aggressively intervene into these nations with some benevolent imperialism. And this argument was upgraded in the context of the war on terror to the degree that the National Intelligence Council of the US affirmed that there was, and I'm quoting them, a great arc of instability stretching from sub-Saharan Africa through to North Africa into the Middle East, the Balkans, the Caucasus, and South and Central Asia, and parts of Southeast Asia. And so I think that gives context to that now famous statement George Bush made days after the September 11 attacks when he said, you're either with us or you're with the terrorists. This became the dividing line in world politics, and liberals, the soft left and reformists fell well and truly down on the wrong side of that line when they picked US imperialism and global military domination against any nation or political movement that opposed them and against Muslims, Arabs, refugees the world over who've paid the biggest price for the US's wars. The unity ticket of the ALP and Liberal Party support for the war continued for its entire 20-year duration as the US and its partners became more and more bogged down in a macabre and losing hellscape in which the occupation was routed by resistance from a growing insurgency inside Afghanistan. When Obama and the Democrats announced a troop surge in 2009 and initiated a massive drone bombing campaign after Obama had campaigned against Bush's losing wars in both Afghanistan and Iraq, both Julia Gillard and Kevin Rudd pledged Australia's support for the renewed offensives that plunged Afghanistan into further depravity, and it was after this troop surge and escalation that the atrocities committed by the Australian SAS mostly occurred. Suffice it to say, there has been no liberation for women in Afghanistan, and it's hard to overstate how much worse things are for them now. And I reckon if you think about the legacy of the US's longest war there ever, it's not hard to understand why their war had nothing to do with freedom or democracy. In the first 10 years, we witnessed the spectacle of US soldiers urinating on the corpses of Afghan men, bombing wedding parties over and over again, mass murdering innocent civilians, burning the Quran and other racist Islamophobic acts. Then we had mass drone bombing campaigns. Road security, public health, other infrastructure have been destroyed, not built. Unemployment skyrocketed. Civilians have been killed by crossfire, improvised explosive devices, assassinations, bombings, and night raids into houses of suspected insurgents. And even in the absence of fighting, unexploded ordnance from previous wars and United States cluster bombs continue to kill people. There is an increased rate of diseases due to poverty, collapsing infrastructure. Around 250,000 people have been killed in Afghanistan and Pakistan since 2001. More than 71,000 of those have been civilians. What has increased in Afghanistan for women since 2001 is the suicide rate exponentially. So you don't get freedom and democracy at the end of a cluster bomb or an M16. You don't get freedom and democracy in mass torture facilities like the now notorious Abu Ghraib or Bagram Air Base or Guantanamo Bay, where the US rolled out the most prolific and racist torture regimes it has undertaken in any of its wars. And the wider legacy for the whole world has been immense. We're coming out of an historic period of imperialism that has strengthened the repressive arms of capitalist states the world over. Anti-terror laws and the war on terror, the war of terror, became the excuse for massively curbing civil rights, for incursions on press freedoms, and the criminalization of resistance and dissent. When we consider the plight of absolute heroes like Chelsea Manning, Julian Assange, and Edward Snowden, who bravely stood up to the might of US empire. We've witnessed the greatest, most horrific refugee crisis since the Second World War and the construction of a whole epoch of racism in the form of Islamophobia that gave license to the criminalization, demonization, and incarceration of refugees from the Middle East and beyond, who now still languish in refugee camps, their lives having been destroyed. All of us now have far less freedom and democracy than we've ever had before. And so I'm going to finish up by quoting from the Revolutionary Association of the Women of Afghanistan again, where I think they point us in the direction of the solution to all of this. They say, "It is human nature to resist, and history bears witness. We have the glorious examples of US struggle, Occupy Wall Street, and Black Lives Matter movements. We have seen that no amount of oppression, tyranny, and violence can stop resistance. Women will not be shackled anymore." Just the next morning, this was written a few weeks ago, just the next morning after the Taliban entered the capital, a group of our young, brave women painted graffiti on the walls of Kabul with the slogan, "Down with the Taliban." We think the inhuman US military empire is not only the enemy of the Afghan people, but the biggest threat to world peace and stability. Now that the system is on the verge of decline, it is the duty of all peace-loving, progressive, leftist, and justice-loving individuals and groups to intensify their fight against the brutal warmongers in the White House, the Pentagon, and Capitol Hill. Replacing the rotten system with a just and humane one will not only liberate millions of poor and oppressed American people, but will have a lasting effect on every corner of the world. I think they're right. I think we need revolutions, solidarity with each other to overthrow capitalism and imperialism, to stop imperialist wars. We need anti-imperialist working classes. We need to build anti-imperialist movements with now the world edging ever closer to a war between China and the West. I think the massive revolutionary uprisings that have happened across the Middle East since 2011, the mass solidarity they received, people from all over the world tell us that another world is possible. That's what we should fight for.